This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Find Her by Lisa Gardner, performed by Kirsten Potter. Chapter 1. These are the things I didn't know. When you first wake up in a dark wooden box, you'll tell yourself this isn't happening. You'll push against the lid, of course, no surprise there. You'll beat at the sides with your fists, pummel your heels against the bottom. You'll bang your head again and again, even though it hurts. And you'll scream. You'll scream and scream and scream. Snot will run from your nose, tears will stream from your eyes until your screams grow rough, hiccupy. Then you'll hear sounds that are strange and sad and pathetic, and you'll understand the box, truly get, hey, I'm trapped in a dark wooden box, when you realize those sounds come from you. Pine boxes aren't composed entirely of smooth surfaces. Air holes, for example, can be crudely drilled. When you run your finger around them, when you poke your fingertip into them, desperately seeking something, you'll get splinters. You'll chew out the wooden shards best you can, then you'll suck on your injured digit, licking the blood beading the tip, and make more hurt puppy dog sounds. You're alone in the box. It's frightening, overwhelming, awful. Mostly because you don't yet understand how much you have to fear. You'll get to know the box well, this home away from home. You'll wiggle against it with your shoulders to determine the width. You'll trace the length with your hands, attempt to bring up your feet. Not enough room to bend your knees. Not enough room to roll over. It's exactly your size, as if it's been made just for you. Your very own pine coffin. Straining your lower back, bruising your shoulder blades, paining the back of your head. One convenience, newspapers lining the bottom. You don't notice this detail in the beginning, don't understand it once you do, until the first time you wet yourself. Then spend days lying in your own filth. Like an animal, you'll think. Except most animals are treated better than this. Your mouth will grow parched, your lips chapped. You'll start jamming your fingers into those air holes, ripping apart your own skin just so you'll have something to taste, swallow, suck. You'll know yourself in a way you've never known yourself before. Broken down. Elemental. The stink of your own urine, the salt of your own blood. But you still don't know anything yet. When you finally hear footsteps, you won't believe it. You're delirious, you'll tell yourself. You're dreaming. You're a lost, pathetic waste of human skin. A stupid, stupid girl who should have known better and now just look at you. And yet, the sound of a metal lock jangling on the other side of the box wall inches from your ear. Maybe you cry again. Or would, if you had any moisture left. When you first see his face, the man who has done this to you, you're relieved. Happy, even. You gaze upon his puffy cheeks, his beady eyes, his gaping mouth, yellow-stained teeth, and you think, thank God, thank God, thank God, thank God. He lets you out of the box. Lifts you up, actually, because your legs don't work and your muscles lack all strength and your head lolls, which makes you giggle. Head lolling. One of those words from English class that never made any sense, but there you have it. Heads loll. Your head lolls. God, the smell. Garlic and B.O. and unwashed clothes and skanky hair. Is it you? Is it him? You gag helplessly, and that makes him laugh, as he holds up the bottle of water, as he spells out exactly what you'll have to do in order to earn it. He's fat, old, disgusting, repulsive. The unkempt beard, the greasy hair, the ketchup stain splotching the front of his cheap checkered shirt. You're supposed to be too good for him. Young, fresh, beautiful. The kind of girl who could have her pick of the litter at a frat party. You have moves. Had moves. You cry for your mother. You beg him to let you go as you lie in a crumpled heap at his feet. Then finally, ultimately, with the last of your strength, you remove your clothes. You let him do what he's going to do. You scream, but your throat is too dry to make a sound. You vomit, but your stomach is too empty to yield any contents. You survive. And later, when he finally offers up that bottle of water only to dump it over your head, you lift your hands shamelessly to capture as much of the moisture as you can. You lick it from your palms, chew it from your oily, filthy hair. You wait till he's distracted, then suck that spot of ketchup from his now discarded shirt. Back to the box. The box, the box. The lid hammers now, the lock snaps shut, the repulsive man walks away, leaves you once again all alone, naked, bruised, bloody, knowing things you never wanted to know. Mommy, you whisper, but this monster's real, and there's nothing anyone can do to save you anymore. This is what I do know. There's not much to do day after day trapped in a coffin-sized box. In fact, there's really only one thing worth imagining, obsessing, contemplating minute by minute, hour after terrible hour. One thought that keeps you going, one focus that gives you strength. You'll find it. You'll hone it. Then, if you're anything like me, you'll never let it go. Revenge. But be careful what you wish for. Especially if you're just a stupid girl trapped in a coffin-sized box. Chapter 2. She started with a pomegranate martini. Paid too much, of course. Boston bars being very expensive, pomegranate juice being very trendy. But it was Friday night. Another week survived, and by God, she deserved at least an overpriced fruity cocktail. Besides, she had some faith in herself. Loosen another button of her white-fitted shirt, pull a few clips from her shoulder-length blonde hair. She was 27, fit, and with the kind of ass that brought notice, she might buy her first drink, but odds were she wouldn't be buying the second. She took a sip, cool, sweet, biting. She warmed it on her tongue, then let the vodka slide down her throat, worth every penny of the $14. For a moment she closed her eyes. The bar disappeared, the sticky floor, the strobing lights, the high-pitched squeal of the opening band still warming up. She stood in a void of silence, in a place that was solely hers. When she opened her eyes again, he was standing there. He bought her second drink, then a third, even offered a fourth. But by then the vodka and the dance floor lights were starting to mix in a way that didn't make for a great morning after. Besides, she wasn't an idiot. Whole time Mr. Haven't I Seen You Around Here Before was plying her with martinis, he stuck to beer. He was nice enough looking, she decided, somewhere near the end of martini number two. Muscular, clearly a guy who worked out. Uninspired taste in clothing, though, with his tan slacks, button-up blue-striped shirt. Going for young professional, she supposed, but she noticed his pants were frayed at the hems, his shirt faded from too many washings. When she asked what he did for a living, he tried for charm. Oh, a little of this, a little of that, he said, going with a wink and a grin. But his eyes remained flat, even distant, and she felt the first pinprick of unease. He recovered quickly, produced martini number three. Wasn't wearing a watch, she noticed, as he tried to catch the bartender with a 20, then failed, as the other patrons were flashing hundreds. Not a wedding ring either. Unattached, well-built. Maybe her knight was looking up. She smiled, but it wasn't a happy look. Something moved across her face, that void again. That realization that all these hours, days, weeks later, she still felt alone, would always feel alone, even in a crowded room. It was just as well he didn't turn around. He finally snagged the bartender, white shirt, black tie, the kind of pecs that produced big tips, and got her a fresh drink. She was ready for the fourth martini by then. Why not? It enabled her to talk about her little bit of this and little bit of that with a wink and a grin that matched the gleam in her eyes. And when his gaze lingered on the front of her shirt, the extra button that she might have slipped just moments before, she didn't back away. She let him stare at the lacy hint of her hot pink bra. She let him admire her tits. Why not? Friday night, end of the week. She'd earned this. He wanted to leave the bar at midnight. She made him wait till close. Band was surprisingly good. She liked the way the music made her feel, as if her blood were still alive, her heart still beating in her chest. He was clearly uncomfortable on the dance floor, but it didn't matter. She had moves good enough for both of them. Her white, fitted shirt was now tied beneath her breasts, Daisy Duke style. Her low-riding black dress jeans clung to every curve, her tall leather boots stomping out each rhythmic beat. After a while, he didn't even bother with dancing, but simply swayed in place, watching her. Her arms flung overhead, lifting her breasts, her hips swinging round and round, taut, bare abdomen glistening with sweat. He had brown eyes, she noted, dark, flat, watchful. Predatory, she thought. But this time around, instead of being spooked, she felt a fresh spike of adrenaline. The well-chiseled bartender was staring at her now, too. She did a tour of the dance floor for both of them. Having accepted that fourth martini, her mouth now felt sweet and purple, while her limbs were liquid ice. She could dance all night. Take over this floor, take over this bar, take over this town. Except that wasn't what Mr. Haven't I Seen You Around Here Before wanted. No guy bought a girl 3 overpriced drinks merely for the privilege of watching her dance. Band wrapped up, started putting away their instruments. She missed the music acutely, felt it like a pang to her soul. No more driving bass to power her feet, mask her pain. Now it was just her, Mr. Haven't I Seen You Around Here Before, and the promise of a killer hangover. He suggested they head outside for some fresh air. She wanted to laugh, to tell him he had no idea. Instead, she followed him to the narrow side street covered in littered cigarette butts. He asked her if she wanted to smoke. She declined. He took her hand. Then he pinned her to the side of a blue-painted dumpster, left hand already squeezing her breast, palming her nipple. His eyes weren't flat anymore. They were molten. Predator having secured prey. "Your place or mine?" he demanded. She couldn't help herself. She started to laugh, which was when the evening really took a turn for the worse. Mr. Haven't I Seen You Around Here Before didn't care for being laughed at. He struck quickly, right hand connecting open-palmed against the side of her face. Her head rocked back into the metal dumpster. She heard the crash, registered the pain. But courtesy of 4 martinis, it all felt distant. A bad night happening to someone else. "You a tease?" he yelled at her, hand squeezing her breast, face screaming just inches from hers. This close, she smelled the beer on his breath, noted the distinct webbing of red veins around his nose. Closet drinker. She should have realized that sooner. Kind of guy who liquored up before coming to the bar because it was cheaper that way. Meaning he wasn't there for the booze at all, but to hook up. To find a girl like her and take her home. In other words, he was perfect for her. She should say something, or stomp her heel on the instep of his foot, or grab his pinky, not his whole hand, just the pinky finger, and wrench it back till it touched his wrist. He'd scream. He'd let her go. He'd look into her eyes and realize his mistake, because big cities such as Boston were filled with guys like him, but also with girls like her. She never got a chance. He was shouting, she was smiling, maybe even still laughing, with her head ringing and the taste of blood salting her tongue. Then Mr. Haven't I Seen You Here Before ceased to exist. He was there, then he was gone, replaced by the body-conscious bartender with the amazing pecs and now a very concerned look on his face. "Are you okay?" he asked. "Did he hurt you? Do you need help? Do you want to call the cops?" He offered his arm. She took it, stepping over the body of Mr. Haven't I Seen You Around Here Before, who was knocked, slack-jawed, to the ground. He shouldn't have touched you like that, the bartender informed her soberly, leading her away from the gawkers gathering around, leading her deeper into the shadows beyond the perimeter of the bar's flashing lights. It's okay. I'll take care of you now. As she realized for the first time that the bartender was gripping her arm harder than necessary, not letting go. She tried to talk her way out of it. Even when you knew better, it was a natural place to start. Hey, big boy, what's your hurry? Can't we just slow down? Hey, you're hurting me. But of course he never broke his stride, nor relaxed his bruising grip above her elbow. He was walking funny, keeping her tucked against his side, like two lovers out on a very fast stroll, but his head was tucked down and tilted to the side, keeping his face in the shadows, she realized, so no one could see him. Then it came to her. The line of his posture, the way he moved, she'd seen him before. Not his face, not his features, but the hunch of his shoulders, the rounded bend of his neck. 3 or 4 months ago, summertime, on the evening news, when a Boston College student went out drinking and never came home again. The local stations had repeatedly aired a video clip from a nearby security camera, capturing the girl's last known moments as she was hustled away by an unknown male, head twisted from view. No, she breathed. He didn't acknowledge her protest. They'd come to an intersection. Without hesitation, he yanked her left down a darker, skinnier street that already smelled of urine and dumpster trash and dark things never spoken of again. She dug in her heels, sobering up quickly now, doing her best to resist. At 110 pounds to his 190, her efforts hardly made a difference. He jerked her tighter against him, right arm clamped around her waist and continued on. Stop! She tried to scream, but no sound came out. Her voice was locked in her throat. She was breathless, lungs too constricted to scream. Instead, a faint whimper, a sound she was embarrassed to admit was her own, but knew from past experience had to be. I have a family, she panted at last. He didn't respond. Fresh intersection, new turn, skittering between tall brick buildings out of public view. She already had no idea where they were. Please, stop, she squeezed out. His arm was too tight around her waist, bruising her ribs. She was going to vomit. Willed it to happen, as maybe that would gross him out, convince him to let her go. No such luck. She heaved abruptly, purple liquid spewing from her mouth, spraying her feet, the side of his pants. He grimaced, jerked reflexively away, then quickly recovered and yanked her once again forward, pulling her by the elbow. I'm gonna be sick again, she moaned, feet tangling, finally slowing his momentum. Drank too much. His voice was filled with scorn. You don't understand. You don't know who I am. He paused long enough to adjust his grip on her arm. Shouldn't have come to the bar alone. But I'm always alone. He didn't get it. Or maybe he didn't care. He stared at her, gaze flat, face expressionless. Then his arm shot forward and he socked her in the eye. Her neck snapped back. Her cheek exploded. Her eyes welled with tears. She had a thought. Fleeting. Faint. Maybe the secret to understanding the universe. But then it was gone. And much like Mr. Haven't I Seen You Around Here Before, she ceased to exist. Friday night, end of a long week. She'd earned this. He moved her. By foot, by car, she didn't know, but when she regained consciousness, she was no longer on the mean streets of Boston, but tucked somewhere dark and dank. The floor beneath her bare feet felt cold. Concrete, cracked and uneven, a basement, she thought, or maybe a garage. She could see faintly, enough light from 3 small windows placed high on one wall, not letting in daylight, but a dim yellow haze, as if a streetlight was outside those windows, permitting an ambient glow. She used the wash of illumination to determine several things at once. Her hands were bound in front of her with plastic zip ties. She'd been stripped, completely naked, and at the moment, at least, she was alone. Her heart rate accelerated. Her head hurt, her skin prickling with goosebumps, and odds were she'd miss this state of relative safety soon enough. The kind of guy who knocked out his date and removed every stitch of her clothing wasn't the kind that was going to leave her untouched for long. Even now, he was most likely preparing for the rest of the evening's festivities, humming away to himself, contemplating games he could indulge in with his new toy, feeling like he was the biggest, baddest asshole in town. She smiled then, though once again it wasn't a happy expression on her face. First off, inventory. Basement or garage inevitably meant storage, and, as the saying went, one person's trash was another person's treasure. He'd been stupid not to bind her ankles as well, not as experienced as he thought, not as clever as he was about to wish he'd been. But then people saw what they wanted to see. She'd been taken in by his pecs. He'd no doubt assessed her as an easy blonde. Turned out, they were both in for some surprises this evening. She found a heavy work table. Raising her bound wrists, she skimmed her fingers across the wooden surface. She identified a thick metal vise built into one corner, moved on more quickly in search of what she hoped might be an assortment of tools. But no, he wasn't that stupid, and she wasn't that lucky. No abandoned sharp objects, pliers, hammer. She searched the room's perimeter next, almost tripping over a metal can, then reaching out quickly to grab it before it fell. No sense in alerting him to her conscious state any sooner than necessary. Lid steady, nerves still shaky, she forced herself to continue. The metal can yielded a filled plastic garbage bag. She set it aside in the short term, then paced the remaining two walls. She identified a collection of empty gas cans as well as two plastic jugs. Based on smell, 1 gallon jug held the remains of windshield wiper fluid, the other antifreeze. So she was most likely in a garage. Being Boston, probably a detached unit, allowing the bartender even more privacy. She didn't dwell on what might happen next, why a man like him required such privacy. For that matter, she refused to get caught up in the stickiness of the floor in the rear corner, or the smell that was becoming nearly impossible to ignore, an odor that matched the taste of blood on her tongue. She took the jug of antifreeze and moved it to the bare wooden work table. His first mistake, her first victory. She found a shovel propped up against the wall. With renewed vigor, she placed her plastic bindings against the blade and rubbed vigorously. After a minute or two, she was breathing heavily, sweat stinging her swollen eye. Yet to judge by the feel of the zip tie, nothing. The edge of the spade was too dull or the plastic too durable. She tried for another moment, then forced herself to abandon the effort. Zip ties were tough. Frankly, she would have preferred metal cuffs, but at least he'd done the courtesy of binding her hands in front of her, where she still had considerable use of them, while not pulling the plastic so tight she lost all feeling in her fingertips. She could move her feet, she could move her arms. She could hold herself perfectly still and feel the void right there. Dark, comforting, silent. Alone in a crowded room, she thought, and for a moment her body swayed, listening to music only she could hear. Then she grew serious again. Trash. It was time. She tore through the thin plastic bag using her fingers. First thing that hit her was the stench. Rotten food, rotten flesh, something worse. She gagged, felt tears well in her eyes, and forced down a flood of bile. Now was not the time to be squeamish, as she forced her fingers into oozing garbage she could feel but not see. Paper towels, wet piles of God knows what, discarded food containers, takeout from inside the home, or food he'd brought out here to share with his catch, or munch on himself when taking a break from his entertainment. Halfway through the bag, she came upon a new batch of rotten, more organic-smelling this time. Her fingers moved quicker. Paper-dry petals, squishy green stems, flowers, a tossed bouquet. Because in addition to food, he plied his playthings with treats. More likely, she decided, the last ruse he'd used to lure an unsuspecting victim. Then, in the next instant, it occurred to her, where there's a cheap florist's bouquet. Bound hands moving quickly now, diving into the foul pile, digging determinedly through rancid Chinese food and sticky duck sauce, tossing aside empty coffee cups and more gooey flour carcasses. Plastic. She was seeking the feel of a thin plastic packet, small, square, with a sharp edge. Bang! The noise came from directly behind her. The sound of a hand, a foot, connecting with a metal garage door. She couldn't help herself. She froze. Naked, shivering, elbow deep in garbage, and listened to him once again announce his arrival. Because he wanted her to know he was coming. He wanted her shaking, terrified, curled into a ball, already fearing the worst. That was the kind of man he was. She smiled. And this time it was a happy expression on her face, because now, in her right hand, she had it. The thin packet of flour food. Generously included with most bouquets, and exactly what she'd been looking for. She hadn't lied to him before. He didn't know her, which had been his first, and would now be his last, mistake. Behind her, the garage door began its shaky ascent, him dragging out the suspense as he slowly heaved it open. No more time to wait, no more time to plan. She gripped the packet between her palms, then grabbed the nearly empty jug of antifreeze, moving swiftly across the cracked concrete floor until she stood beneath the row of eyebrow windows, the weak light streaming above her, bathing the middle of the space in a dim glow while keeping her in shadow. Garage door, quarter of the way open, now a third, a half. She released her grip on the packet. Grabbed the antifreeze jug first, pinning it between her feet, then used both hands to press down the child safety lid and twist. The plastic cap clattered to the floor, but the rattle of the heaving metal door covered the sound. Two-thirds of the way open, now three-quarters, enough for a grown man to walk through. She placed the antifreeze to the side, forced herself to take the time to shake the packet, settling the crystals to the bottom. Couldn't afford to waste any if this was to work. He stepped into the space. The bartender with the amazing pecs, shirt already off, muscles rippling in the moonlight, a beautiful physical specimen. She should feel guilty for what she was going to do next. But she didn't. She stepped forward into the dim stream of light, her nakedness clearly exposed, her wrists clearly bound. He smiled, right hand already moving to the waistband of his jeans. "You don't know who I am," she said clearly. He paused, regarded her quizzically, as if she'd challenged him with complicated math. Then the bartender moved toward her. She ripped open the plastic packet, took three quick steps forward, and tossed the contents into his face. He reared back, coughing and blinking as the flour food hit his eyes, nose, mouth. "What the—" She grabbed the open jug of antifreeze, swirled it three times, and then— A suspended heartbeat of time. He looked at her, stared hard, and in that instant they finally saw each other. Not a ripped bartender, not a stupid blonde, but dark heart to lost soul. She sprayed the antifreeze straight into his face, splashed it onto his exposed skin and the granules of potassium permanganate still clinging there. One more heartbeat of time, then the first tendrils of smoke. From his hair, his cheeks, his eyelashes, the man lifted his hands to his face, then basic chemistry took over, and the bartender's skin burst into flame. He screamed. He ran. He beat at his own head as if it would make a difference. He did everything but stop, drop, and roll, panic having its way. She stood there, not moving a muscle, not saying a word. She watched until at last he collapsed into a pile of smoking ruin. Other sounds penetrated then. Neighbors calling out into the dark, demanding to know what was going on. The distant sounds of sirens, as apparently one of the smarter ones had already called 911. The woman finally stepped forward. She peered down at her attacker's remains, watched the smoky tendrils drift from his now blackened skin. Friday night, she thought. She'd earned this.
Chapter 3. Who is she? Don't know. Neighbor over there, Kyle Petrakis, claims he found her standing over the body, stripped naked, hands tied, face bashed. She did all this with her hands tied? Sergeant Detective D.D. Warren knelt down, studied the charred remains of their victim? Perpetrator? Body was curled in a near-fetal position, hands clenched over the young male's face, a protective gesture, which, judging by the burn patterns across his head, shoulders, and face, had been too little too late.
Chemical fire,
the third detective spoke up. Combine potassium permanganate with antifreeze, and poof! Dee Dee ignored the third detective, glancing up at Phil instead.
So what do we know?
House belongs to Alan and Joyce Goulding, her former squad mate rattled off. Older couple currently waiting out the winter chill in Florida. They left behind, however, their youngest son, 28-year-old Devin Goulding, who trains as a bodybuilder by day, works as a bartender by night. This is Devin? Dee Dee asked, gesturing to the body. Gonna have to wait on fingerprints for that one. Dee Dee grimaced, made the mistake of breathing through her nose, grimaced harder. Where's our victim-turned-vixen now? Back of a squad car, refused medical attention, waiting on the feds, whom she called directly.
The feds?
Dee Dee rose to standing, voice curt. What do you mean she personally invited the feds to our party? Who the hell is this girl? Detective number three did the honors. She called the Boston field office and requested Dr. Samuel Keynes. Dialed the number off the top of her head, I might add.
Would you still call it a party?
The newest member of Boston Homicide asked, conversationally. Or is it more like a barbecue? Dee Dee walked away, turned on her heel, left the body, exited the garage. In her new and improved supervisory role, she could get away with such things. Or maybe it was due to her current classification as restricted duty. The fact that Detective Number 3 had taken Dee Dee's former position with her former squad, an assignment Dee Dee could no longer hold, given her recent injury, was no reason to shun the 35-year-old recruit. No. Currently, Dee Dee held the woman's name against her. Carol, as in Carol Manley. Sounded like an insurance agent. Or maybe a soccer mom. But definitely not a cop. No kind of serious detective went by Carol. Of course, no kind of serious homicide unit sergeant obsessed about a new detective's name, or was petty enough to hold it against her. Maybe. A year ago, Dee Dee hadn't worried about women named Carol, or the future of her three-member squad, or her own role with the BPD's homicide unit. She lived, ate, and breathed death investigations, and was a happier person for it. Until the evening, she returned for a late-night analysis of a crime scene and startled the killer still lurking there. One brief altercation later, she'd toppled down a flight of stairs and suffered an avulsion fracture to her left arm. No more lifting her gun, no more lifting her small child. For the next 6 months, Dee Dee had gotten to sit at home, nursing her wounds, worrying about her future, and, yeah, losing her mind. But slowly and surely, as her physical therapist, Russ, had promised her, the hard work had started to pay off. Until one day she could shrug her shoulder, and another day she could slowly but surely raise her arm. Her strength wasn't there yet, nor full range of motion. She could execute such things as, say, the two-handed weaver stance for shooting. But her pain was manageable, her injury improving, and her overall state of health excellent. Enough to convince the powers that be to allow her to return under restricted duty status, meaning she now spent more time supervising as a sergeant than engaging in hands-on investigating as a detective. She told herself she could handle it. The work was the work, and either way she was solving crimes. Of course, she continued to engage in thrice-weekly occupational therapy sessions, where she used a hand weight in lieu of her hand gun and practiced the motion of unsnapping her holster, then drawing and firing over and over again. She also spent time on the shooting range, one-handed. Not as reliable, not department SOP, but she had to start somewhere. Otherwise, Phil and Neil two of the finest detectives on the force, would forever be saddled with a rookie. The Gouldings' garage was a detached, single-car unit set in the back of the property. Striding forward, Dee Dee vacated the structure, crossed the modest backyard, and headed for the street. Sun was just coming up, a gray, chilly dawn that seemed almost anticlimactic given the current level of activity. Patrol cars were stacked up along both sides of the busy neighborhood street, as well as the ME's vehicle and several larger, more impressive, media vans. The first responders had done an admirable job of roping off the property, from the gray-painted two-story colonial to the dilapidated rear garage. The officers had seized it all, establishing a strict perimeter of yellow crime scene tape that would make Dee Dee's job that much easier. Nosy neighbors contained to the sidewalk across the street? Check. Rabid reporters confined to 50 yards away from the closest law enforcement officer? Check. And now for the trifecta. Dee Dee discovered the woman sitting in the back of the third patrol car, shoulders shivering slightly beneath a blue BPD blanket, face staring straight ahead. A district detective sat beside her. The rear car door sat open, as if they were waiting for something or someone. Neither was saying a word. Margaret, Dee Dee acknowledged the officer on the far side of the vehicle. This close, she realized why the vehicle door had been left ajar. Back at the crime scene, investigators had marked a bag of rotting food that had been pulled out of a trash can and torn open. The woman must have been at least elbow deep in that mess, given the scent of rancid meat and sour milk wafting from her skin, let alone the streaks of slime marring her cheeks and mucking her hair. Dee Dee, the district detective replied stoically, heard you were back. Congrats.
Thanks. Dee Dee's gaze remained focused on the woman,
the alleged killer, the alleged victim. The girl appeared young, mid to late 20s would be Dee Dee's guess, with shoulder-length blonde hair and delicate features that would probably be found attractive if not for the assortment of bruises, smatters of blood, and smears of rot. The girl didn't look at her, but continued to focus on the back of the driver's seat. Flat effect, Dee Dee noted. An expression most often found in homicide cops or victims of chronic abuse. Standing outside the patrol car, Dee Dee leaned down until her face was even with the woman's. Sergeant Detective Dee Dee Warren, she said by way of introduction. And you are? The girl finally turned her head. She stared at Dee Dee, seemed to study her as if looking for something. Then she resumed her examination of the back of the driver's seat. Dee Dee gave it some thought. Quite the scene in the garage. Chemical fire, I'm told. Basically, you burned a man alive with some kind of preservative mixed with antifreeze. You learned that as a Girl Scout? Nothing. Let me guess. Devin seemed nice enough when you first met. Good-looking guy, hard-working. You decided to give love a chance.
Devin?
The woman finally spoke, gaze still locked straight ahead. Her voice sounded husky, as if she'd smoked too much, or screamed too loud. Victim's name, Devin Goulding. What, you never got around to asking? Cool blue eyes. Gray, Dee Dee thought, as the girl glanced over.
Didn't know him, the girl said. We'd never met.
And yet here we are.
He's a bartender, the girl offered, as if that should mean something to Dee Dee.
Then it did. You went out tonight, to the bar where Devin worked. That's how you met.
We didn't meet, the girl insisted. I was there with someone else. The bartender? He followed us out. She stared at Dee Dee again. He's done this before, she stated matter-of-factly. August, that girl who went missing, Stacy Summers. The way he grabbed me, tucked his head to hide his face from view as he pulled me down the back streets, he matches the man in the abduction video. I would search his property thoroughly.
Stacy Summers was a Boston College student who disappeared in August. Young, beautiful, blonde, she had the kind of beaming smile and gorgeous headshots guaranteed to grab nationwide headlines, which the case had. Unfortunately, 3 months later, the police possessed only a single grainy video image of her being dragged away from a local bar by a large, shadowy brute. That was it. No witnesses, no suspects, no leads. The case had grown cold, even if the media attention had not. "Do you know Stacy Summers?" Dee Dee asked. The girl shook her head. "Friend of the family? Fellow college student? Someone who once met her at a bar?"
"No."
"Are you a cop?"
"No."
"FBI?" Another shake. "So your interest in the Stacy Summers case?"
"I read the news."
"Of course." Dee Dee tilted her head sideways, contemplated her subject. "You know federal agents," she stated. "Family friend? Neighbor? But you know someone well enough to dial direct."
"He's not a friend."
"Then who is he?"
A faint smile. "I don't know. You'd have to ask him."
"What's your name?" Dee Dee straightened up. Her left shoulder was starting to bother her now, not to mention this conversation's strain on her patience.
"He didn't know my name," the girl said. "The bartender, this Devon, he didn't care who I was. I arrived at the bar alone. According to him, that's all it took to make me a victim."
"You were at the bar alone? Drank alone?"
"Only the first drink. That's generally how it works."
"How many drinks did you have?"
"Why? Because if I'm drunk, I deserved it?"
"No, because if you're drunk, you're not as reliable a witness."
"I danced with one guy most of the night. Others saw us. Others can corroborate."
Dee Dee frowned, still not liking the woman's answers, nor her use of the word corroborate, a term generally favored by law enforcement, not laypeople. "Dancer's name?"
"Mr. Haven't I seen you around here before?" the girl murmured.
On the other side of the girl, the district detective rolled her eyes. Apparently, Dee Dee wasn't the first person to be asking these questions or getting these answers. "Can he corroborate?" Dee Dee stressed the legal term.
"Assuming he's regained consciousness."
"Honey,
you should search the garage. There's blood in the far left corner. I could smell it when I was digging through the trash, trying to find a weapon."
"Is that when you discovered the potassium permanganate?"
"He's the one who threw away the bouquet, probably after using it to lure in some other victim. I'm not his first. I can tell you, he was much too confident, too well prepared. If this is his house, check his room. He'll have trophies. Predator like him enjoys the private thrill of revisiting past conquests."
Dee Dee stared at the woman. In her years in homicide, she'd interviewed victims who were hysterical. She'd dealt with victims who were in shock. When it came to crime, there was no such thing as an emotional norm. And yet, she'd never met a victim like this one. The woman's responses were well beyond the bell curve. Hell, outside the land of sanity. "Did you know what Devon..." The bartender had done to these other women? Maybe a friend of yours told you something, her own scary experience, or rumors of something that may have happened to a friend of a friend?
"No."
"But you suspected something," Dee Dee continued, voice hard. "At the very least, you think he was involved with the disappearance of another girl, a case plastered all over the news. So what? You decided to take matters into your own hands? Turn yourself into some kind of hero and make your own headlines?"
"I'd never met the bartender before tonight. I left with a different loser. He was the one I was trying to set up."
The girl shrugged, gaze once more locked on the back of the driver's seat.
"The evening's been filled with surprises. Even for someone like me, these things can happen."
"Who are you?"
That smile again. The one that was not a smile, but something far more troubling rippling across the girl's face. "I didn't know the bartender. I've read about the Stacy Summers case. Who hasn't? But I never thought... Let's just say I didn't plan on some overpumped nightclub employee knocking me unconscious or carting me off as his personal plaything. Once it happened, though, I know survival skills. I know self-defense. I utilized the resources I found on hand.
You went through his trash, wouldn't you?"
The girl stared at her.
For once, Dee Dee was the one who looked away.
"He started the war," the girl stated clearly. "I simply ended it."
"Then called the FBI."
"I didn't have any choice in that matter."
Dee Dee suddenly had an inkling. It wasn't a good feeling. She studied her victim, a mid-20s female obviously experienced with law enforcement and personal defense. The special agent, is he your father? The girl finally took her seriously. She said, worse.
Chapter 4. In the beginning I cried, which in time led to a sort of mindless humming, making noise for the sake of making noise, because it's hard to be alone in a dark wooden box. Sensory deprivation, the kind of torture used to break hardened assassins and radicalized terrorists, because it works. The pain was the worst. The relentless hard surface denting the soft spot on the back of my skull, straining my lower back, bruising my bony heels. I would feel the ache like a fire across my skin until my entire nervous system roared its outrage, but there was nothing I could do. No new position I could adopt, not a twist here or a bend there to relieve the pressure, to be trapped. Pinned, really, flat on your back on a hard pine plank, minute after minute after minute. I think there were times, especially in the beginning, when I wasn't sane. Humans are interesting, however. Our ability to adapt is truly impressive. Our rage against our own suffering, our relentless need to find a way out, to do something, anything, to advance our lot in life. I made the first improvement in my living conditions by accident. In a fit of fury against the pain in the back of my skull, I lifted my head and smacked my forehead against the wooden lid. Maybe I hoped to knock myself unconscious. Wouldn't have surprised me. What I received was a sharp sting to my front right temple, which did, at least temporarily, alleviate the ache in the back of my head, which led to more discoveries. Your back throbs? Smack a knee. Your knee hurts? Stub a toe. Your toe hurts? Jam a finger. Pain is a symphony, a song of varying intensities and many, many notes. I learned to play them. No longer a helpless victim in a sea of suffering, but a mad orchestral genius directing the music of my own life. Alone, trapped inside a coffin-sized box, I sought out each tiny register of discomfort and mastered it. Which led in turn to leg lifts and shoulder shrugs and the world's most abbreviated bicep curls. He came. He worked the padlock. He removed the lid. He lifted me out of the depths and reveled in his godlike powers. Afterward, a small offering of liquid, perhaps even a scrap of food as he tossed the dog the proverbial bone, he'd stay to watch, laughing as I cracked open the dried-up chicken wing and greedily sucked out the marrow. Then back to the box. He would leave, and I belonged to myself again, alone in the dark, master of my pain. I cried. I railed against God. I begged for someone, anyone, to save me. But only in the beginning, slowly but surely. Dimly, then with greater clarity, I began to think, plot, scheme. One way or another, I was getting out of this. I'd do whatever it took to survive. And then, I was going home.
Chapter 5. Dee Dee discovered Neil in the upstairs rear bedroom of the two-story house. The youngest member of the three-man squad, Neil was famous for his shock of red hair and perpetually youthful face. Most suspects dismissed him as a new recruit, which Dee Dee and Phil had never stopped using to their advantage. These days, Neil carried himself with more poise. In the past couple of years, Dee Dee and Phil had been pushing him to step up, take the lead. It had resulted in a few battles, given Neil remained most at home overseeing autopsies in the morgue, but Dee Dee liked to think she'd raised him right. Certainly with her gone and Phil now serving as lead detective of the squad, Neil had better be lording over Carol, Dee Dee thought. It was the least he could do for her. Neil glanced up as she walked in. He was kneeling on the floor beside a rumpled queen-size bed, holding a shoebox pulled from beneath the mattress. Dee Dee made it 3 feet into the cramped, dank space and wrinkled her nose. It smelled like unwashed sheets, cheap cologne, and gym socks. In other words, like the home of a bachelor male.
Devin Goulding's room? She asked.
Looks like it.
Arrested development, she muttered. Neil arched a brow.
We can't all be Alex, he observed.
Alex was Dee Dee's husband, crime scene reconstruction specialist and instructor at the police academy. One of the more refined members of the species, Dee Dee liked to think. He had impeccable taste in clothing, food, and, of course, his wife. He also looked pretty good with mushy Cheerios glued to his cheek, which is how most breakfasts with their 4-year-old son ended. Alex actually enjoyed doing laundry. Devin Goulding, on the other hand...
Got anything?
Dee Dee gestured to the shoebox in Neil's hand. Say, a stash of trophies from previous victims? According to our femme fatale, who apparently had never met Mr. Goulding before this evening, he's definitely done this before and might even be the perpetrator responsible for the Boston College student who went missing in August. Neil blinked.
You mean the Stacey Summers case?
So I'm told.
By the woman who torched Devin in his own garage with her hands still tied.
The one and only.
Who is she again?
Interestingly enough, she was more forthcoming on Devin's alleged crimes than her own. But she's convinced he's a serial predator, and we should definitely check for trophies.
She looks familiar, Neil said. I can't quite place her, but when I first arrived and spotted her, I thought I knew her from somewhere.
Quantico?
Dee Dee asked helpfully, as Neil had recently attended a training seminar there for detectives, and it would certainly explain the woman's knowledge of criminal behavior. But Neil was shaking his head.
I don't think so. Then again...
You ever hear about this chemical fire thing?
She asked him now, Neil having the most extensive science background on her squad.
Former squad.
Yeah. One of those survival tactics for when lost in the wilderness, that sort of thing. Gotta admit, though, if I woke up trapped in a garage with my hands bound, not sure that's the first thing that would pop into my head.
Seems to indicate higher than average self-defense skills.
Here's the thing, though, Neil continued, rising to his feet. It shouldn't have killed Goulding. Incapacitated, maimed, traumatized, sure, but localized burning, relatively low heat. You'd be amazed at how much the human body can endure and keep on ticking. I've seen victims pulled from fiery wrecks with 2/3 of their skin toasted, and still, with enough time and treatment, they make it.
Dee Dee shuddered. She didn't like burns. She'd once been sent to interview a survivor in a burn unit who was having the dead skin literally scraped from his back. Based on the guy's screams, she'd assumed he was dying, only to be told the whole treatment was designed to fix him. Not enough morphine in the world, the nurse had offered helpfully, scouring away.
Now, it's possible Devin inhaled heat and smoke into his throat, Neil was saying. Maybe seared his esophagus, which swelled up, closing his airway. But what the witness described sounded more instantaneous. Which made me think maybe he went into shock and his heart stopped beating.
Okay, Dee Dee said. She still didn't know where they were going with this, but Neil had worked as an EMT before he became a cop. He often saw things she and Phil didn't. Of course, the deceased is a young, obviously fit male, bodybuilder by the looks of things.
You could see that? Dee Dee asked incredulously, recalling the curled-up lump of charred remains.
You couldn't?
Never mind.
Which leads to further considerations. Bodybuilders have been known to dabble in anabolic steroids, which in turn can lead to a whole host of symptoms, including high blood pressure and an enlarged heart.
And shrunken testicles, Dee Dee offered up. High blood pressure is news to me, but the shrunken testicles I'm pretty sure about.
Neil rolled his eyes. We'll let the ME measure testicle size. Based on this, however, we're probably both right.
He jiggled the shoebox, and Dee Dee could hear the telltale noise of glass vials rattling together. Devin Goulding was definitely shooting up roids. For how long, I couldn't tell you, but even short-term use could have impacted his heart and been a contributing factor in his death.
What about roid rage? Dee Dee asked, considering the matter.
I always thought that meant flying off the handle, but could it have led him to abduct a girl from a bar?
Beyond my pay grade, Neil said with a shrug. In theory, long-term steroid abuse leads to diminished sex drive, which begs the question why he would want to kidnap a girl from a bar.
Giving in to his darker impulses was the only way he could get interested anymore? Violence, his last remaining turn-on?
Neil shrugged.
Your guess is as good as mine. Based upon this box, I think we can safely assume Devin Goulding used steroids, and it probably was a factor in his death. As for evidence of past crimes, additional victims, only one way to find out.
Neil set down the box, took one step toward the narrow dresser that was crammed up against the wall, and started pulling out drawers.
Dee Dee let him do it. She was on restricted duty, after all. Neil could ransack the room. She crossed to the bed and inspected the contents of Goulding's shoebox. In addition to various colorfully labeled glass jars, there were numerous baggies of unmarked pills, supplements, hormones, God only knew. Could steroid abuse have led to Goulding's crime spree? Their lone survivor had implied she hadn't known him at all, had been at the bar with another man until Goulding had knocked out Bachelor A and absconded with the girl. Certainly sounded primitive enough. It also sounded impulsive to Dee Dee. Serial predators were more likely to stalk their victims, plan out the abduction, whereas snatching a girl from outside a bar...
Hey!
Neil interrupted her thoughts. He'd given up on the drawers and was once more on his hands and knees, feeling beneath the bureau with his gloved hand.
Got something?
Maybe.
It took him several tugs. Then he retrieved a large, plain, yellow manila envelope that had been taped to the bottom of the dresser. He shook it, and Dee Dee saw several small rectangular shapes move against the paper sheath. Neil carried the envelope to the bed. The top flap wasn't glued down, but fastened shut with metal tabs. He flipped them up, then did the honors of opening the envelope and pouring its contents onto the bed. Dee Dee counted two credit card-size objects, except they weren't credit cards.
Driver's licenses, Neil said. Two females.
Christy Kilker, Natalie Draga.
But not Stacy Summers?
No Stacy Summers.
Then again...
Neil held up one of the licenses to show a single bloody fingerprint.
I think our world's most dangerous Girl Scout may have been onto something after all.
They tore the rest of the room apart, Dee Dee starting with the bed, Neil continuing on to the dresser. They moved methodically and efficiently, teammates who'd done this kind of thing before. Later, the crime scene techs would return with fingerprint powder, luminol, and alternative light sources. They'd retrieve fingerprints, bodily fluids, and hopefully minuscule strands of hair and fiber. For now, Dee Dee and Neil went for the obvious. Women's clothing, jewelry, anything that could tie back to other victims. Pay stubs and bar bills that might indicate other hunting grounds. And, what the hell, a killer's diary. You never knew when you might get lucky. Dee Dee had to have Neil's help to lift the top mattress. Her shoulder already throbbed, her left arm too weak for the job. Neil didn't say anything. He came over. Together they lifted, then he returned to his corner and she resumed her search of the bed. She was grateful for her partner's... former partner's... silence. The fact that he didn't comment on the sheen of sweat already collecting on her brow, her clear shortness of breath... Supervisors were hardly expected to work crime scenes, Dee Dee reminded herself. Request paperwork on the subject, review all notes, sure. But this actual work thing? No. She was supposed to be safely ensconced back at HQ, where her lack of ability to carry a sidearm wouldn't be a liability to herself and others. Dee Dee searched every square inch under the top mattress, then went to work on the box spring. Later, she would have to ice down, while enduring Alex's knowing stare.
But she was who she was. He knew it. Neil knew it. It was simply the Boston Police Department she was determined to fool.
Got something. She could feel it now, a hard lump near the top right corner of the box spring. Up close, she could see that the seam where the heavy-duty material from the sides of the box spring met with the flimsy top cover was frayed. She poked around with her gloved fingertips, and sure enough, wedged between a nest of coils, a box. Hang on.